I'm telling these tears, go and fall away, fall away. Oh, may the last one burn into flames. Freedom, freedom. What's up, Wisconsin? I am Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. On Monday this past week, my producer, but on Monday guest, Anya Esther, joined me to observe Holocaust Remembrance Day. And as Anya and I were talking about the topic and getting prepared for Monday's show, which you can find at civicmedia.us, we thought that it also made sense to try to talk about both Holocaust denialism and what genocide prevention actually looks like today. Much of our international system of laws related to genocide prevention, namely intervention, right? Intervention by some countries, generally in another sovereign nation's conduct of its business. Nearly that entire legal system, including the creation of the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, etc., all sprung from World War II and the Holocaust. But America's grappling with genocide and how we respond and when we respond and what does that mean goes back much, much further than World War II. And it is complicated. It is complicated to say the very, very least. So we're going to jump in here. Again, you're welcome to call. You're welcome to text, to share. I grew up in a time in the 90s where genocides were, frankly, in the news nearly every day. Slobodan Milosevic was sort of paramount in a lot of my in-classroom learning in both grade school and high school. The genocide in Rwanda, in Sudan, these were all part of the international relations, the foreign policy discussions growing up. And I myself was a bit of a student, not of the genocide per se, but of how do nations engage in foreign policy? Because it is so very complicated. And here we find ourselves today in this very moment having these same discussions again. I don't think Anya and I are going to give you answers today, but we'll sure try to have a discussion. So again, welcome. I'm Maggie Dawn. I'm joined by my usual producer, but today's special guest, Anya Esther, to talk about genocide prevention, to talk about Holocaust denialism, and hopefully to remind ourselves very humbly that these questions, the complexities of how does society, how do we as Americans respond to genocide or humanitarian crises? These are eternal questions that politicians and our country have always struggled with. So welcome, Anya. Thanks for doing this with me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me on again. This is, a hard topic, as was Monday, but an important topic. And so I'm happy, excited, if that's the right term at all, to be here to do that work with you.
Yeah, weighty work, but important.
Yes.
Again, folks, you want to join our conversation, you have questions, comments, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. I thought we would start with some of the sound that you gave to Calvin, who I should also thank for being here and running the board for us today. You are appreciated, Calvin.
I'm happy to be here, as always.
Thank you. But I thought we would start with the I hate your neighbor sound that you have, and let's just take a listen.
Really? Are you a racist?
It's really not skin color for me. I'm more of an anti-Semite. And I believe
the
biggest demon.
I guess that.
Would you think there should be another genocide?
I don't think there ever was genocide to begin with.
Sabine, what do you think should happen to the Jews?
I think there should be another genocide. Or a genocide. You're all looking at me puzzled.
That's pretty hard.
Even my husband, you know?
And when you say genocide, you mean the women, the children, the kids?
Absolutely.
Why?
She's holding them right there, those two reasons.
Because they're a poison and they need to be eradicated so my children and all the other white children have a chance in this world.
And you think genocide is the answer?
Yes.
I love you, baby.
There's a word in that sound that jumped out at me, and that was poisoning, right? And the Republican nominee for the president of the United States has used that language to great applause, to great fanfare, repeatedly, poisoning the blood of America. I don't know that that's an American value. But again, trying to zoom back out and think about this in terms of what's our moral responsibility? What is the legal framework for intervention in the face of genocide? And what does history have to teach us? And again, the international legal structure comes largely from World War II. I'm sure we'll talk about the fact that at the gates to Dachau, there is a plaque that has written in many, many languages, never again. And yet we heard in that clip, oh, I didn't think there wasn't a Holocaust. I don't believe that. What, Anya, what does this bring up for you? Have you experienced people espousing these views either indirectly or directly? I mean, that is revolting.
Yeah, that clip is really haunting. To give it some context, that's from the Vice TV show Hate Thy Neighbor, season one, episode one. You can find both seasons on YouTube. It's a really stirring show. You should definitely watch it, about neo-Nazism in America. And this is a couple, a husband and wife. The husband starts out by saying he doesn't think there was a genocide, and she tries to agree and
she
then
slips.
Says,
yes,
but there should be another. How, you know. What it brings up for me, other than the rage and the sickness in my stomach, is, yeah, I have experienced not something as direct as what these two folks have said, but a couple quick instances. Growing up in Wausau, before I'd even finished my Jewish conversion, but I'd been semi-public with my peers about the fact that I was looking into converting, it was the summer of 2015. So on my way to Badger Girl State. Were you a Badger Girl State girl, Maggie, by any chance?
I wasn't, but no. I had some friends that did that. Yes.
There you go. Well, we were getting in the car to go, and we woke up that morning to find that someone had burned a swastika into the pavement in front of our house with what appeared to just be lighter fluids. So that was my first instance. And then as recently as this year, these past 3 months, I'll leave the name of the business out because it wasn't their fault, but I went into a Upper East Side business in Milwaukee. And like many businesses, when you walk in, they had a bulletin board and some area for people to leave business cards and pamphlets. And one caught my eye. It was a bright blue pamphlet. There were about six of them. And it said, should you be concerned about free speech limitations surrounding research about the Holocaust? And that's such a, it's so many things.
Yeah.
And of course, I opened it and I quickly read through it and found that it was a bunch of conjecture, essentially saying, isn't it weird that, and everything it was pointing to was essentially saying glaringly, well, we'd like to talk about the Holocaust, but didn't do the research. So isn't it strange that we don't know what we're talking about? I touched base with the owner. I said, you should be aware that these were placed here. Clearly you didn't place them here, but someone has come into your venue and placed rhetoric, a pamphlet that essentially says you should be concerned that maybe the Holocaust wasn't real. And I found that while just going to pick up a morning treat with my boyfriend, here's this pamphlet that says, hey, maybe this huge genocide wasn't real. And that was truly jarring for me.
Yeah.
To find that mixed in with, like, come learn how to drum, and if you need a math tutor, and if you need someone to walk your dog,
new
and
yoga
also,
studio,
exactly. And also, maybe it wasn't 6 million. Maybe it was only. It's horrifying, horrifying stuff.
I'm sorry that that happened to you. Let me just say that.
Thank you.
I wanted to, one of the first public political debates about American response and do we intervene in the face of genocide goes back to before World War I.
Yep, absolutely.
Right. And that's the Armenian genocide. And I just pulled a whole bunch of stuff. We'll talk about a lot of it today, but I wanted to talk a little bit about this. There's a book, a sort of seminal text out there. It's Samantha Power's A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, came out of the 90s. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. But one of the complexities is that Woodrow Wilson often is thought of as an anti-interventionist. But he was faced with what was a very complicated political atmosphere. And before that time, America had basically operated on a principle of non-intervention. That was just what we were. It was very isolationist. And in fact, that's, you know, the Monroe Doctrine, right? If you think back on these things. And if you go way far back, George Washington's farewell address basically adopted a non-interventionist or isolationist posture. Some called it non-entanglement. Sort of a nice way to put lipstick on that sort of a pig.
Right.
And at the time, I just want to share these words. This was during the public debate pre-World War I. Republican Senator Warren Harding, who succeeded Wilson as president in 1920, summed up the Republican position on whether or not America should intervene in the Armenian genocide. He said this: "I am not insensible to the suffering of Armenia, but I am thinking of America first. Safety as well as charity begins at home." America first. I wonder where I've heard that lately. We'll continue to dig in. I'm Maggie Dawn. She's Anya Esther. Bit of a heavy topic today. Keep it locked, everybody. We'll be back in just a moment.
I was born by the river in a little tent. And just like
welcome back.
River, I've been running.
I'm Maggie Dawn. She's Anya Esther. We are talking about some tough stuff today. A sort of sequel to our Monday episode that was an observation of Holocaust Remembrance Day. We're talking today about isolationism. What is our moral responsibility as Americans, as Wisconsinites, as people of good faith that enjoy civil society here? And what can each one of us do in the face of genocide? And we were just talking last segment about the fact that this question of whether to intervene and how to intervene and under what circumstances is an age-old one and goes back to even George Washington's time and the Monroe Doctrine. One of the most ardent advocates for intervention in the very late 19th century and early 20th century was Theodore Roosevelt, interestingly enough. He tried to articulate a set of principles for the United States that would define when we respond to what he called then crimes against civilization. And in the forefront of his mind was the Armenian genocide that had been occurring between 1894 and 1896 in advance, sort of the more well-known atrocities of 1915. And even then, even as Theodore Roosevelt tried to articulate principles for American intervention in the face of genocide, Again, language of that time, Secretary of State criticized him. This is Secretary of State Richard Olney back then, criticized Roosevelt for, quote, lecturing a foreign state upon the management of its internal affairs. We're talking about the same stuff today. I mean, and this, again, is some language from Roosevelt. He believed that, quote, the cases in which we could interfere by force of arms are necessarily few. It was inevitable that the country should desire eagerly to give expression to its horror when it witnesses such systematic and long-extended cruelty and oppression of which the Armenians have been victims. And in Europe at the time, this was not met with open arms. This was viewed very much as Americans trying to meddle in the affairs of Europe. And again, we've got to think of this in its proper historical context. This, of course, leads to the Treaty of Versailles, which sets Europe and the world on this inevitable, what should not have been an inevitable course to confront Hitler in World War II. Many scholars that talk about genocide say that the only way to intervene in genocide is to prevent it in the very first instance, that once the first killing has happened, it is already too late. And by that time, you are most likely talking about military intervention of some sort, which then resurrects these ideas of isolationism. Again, Warren Harding in 1920 summed up the Republican position of that time when he declared, "I am not insensible to the sufferings of Armenia, but I am thinking of America first. Safety as well as charity begins at home." And even then, it was being debated. At that time, Walter Lippmann in the New Republic declared this: "If we fail at this juncture to vindicate Armenia's right to freedom, we shall never again persuade the world that our moral sentiments are anything but empty rhetoric, playing over a gulf of selfishness and sloth." And this language is from the Republican Party platform. They actually had one back in 1920, Anya. This is the Republican presidential platform of 1920. Quote, "No more striking illustration can be found of President Wilson's disregard for the lives of American boys or American interests than his request for an Armenian mandate," in other words, to intervene. Americans should not confuse the humanitarian and material aid they should extend and the political control they ought to avoid. I couldn't help in doing some of this research and discuss the echoes of today. What is, you know, you and I are of, I think if we can safely say, so different generations, Anya.
Yeah.
Which is good because you bring to the table, again, that different perspective, which I value. When you think about these things, when you think about what's happening in our world today, these questions, this continued pernicious anti-Semitism in the United States, statements by the former MAGA president in response to overt anti-Semitism, the embracing of Nazi ideology and symbology. I'm thinking of Charlottesville in Virginia, the former MAGA president's words that there are good people on both sides.
Right.
What? How do you experience that?
Well, I'll say it like this. You can promote isolationism as a policy, but you cannot enforce isolationism when it comes to people. And I'll explain maybe a little further in a recommendation of a book. Before Poland was invaded,
yes,
there were small neighborhoods, small towns who, sensing the Nazis were going to invade and were aware of the Nazis' feelings towards Jews and what they intended to do with those Jews, rounded up their neighbors and killed their Jewish neighbors in advance of the Nazis arriving. Some did it for fear that being found living with Jews they would be sentenced to the same fate, or maybe somehow getting brownie points. So Poland at that moment, right, was also attempting to be isolationists. We won't get involved with whatever Germany's doing. Let them be. But of course, the knowledge, the fear, the choices had already entered Poland and were enacted by the individuals. So we can want to not get tangled up in it as much as we want. The truth is, the ropes of tanglement are already around us. There is no staying disentangled. There's only disentangling yourself. We're a little past that point, I think. And the book that this story comes from is Neighbors, The Destruction of the Jewish Community in Jebwadne by Jan T. Gross. His last name, Gross, spelt just how it sounds.
Wow. This is President Franklin Roosevelt in 1935 saying this. Despite what happens in continents overseas, the United States of America shall and must remain, as the father of our country prayed that it might remain, unentangled and free. Other nations may, as they do, enforce contrary rules of conscience and conduct. Those policies are, however, beyond our jurisdiction. We will continue in just a few moments. You're going to have a farm update. Then Anya and I will be back. An extension of Holocaust Remembrance Day this past Monday, dealing with the very real racism, anti-Semitism, and challenges that we see in the world today. Don't go anywhere. I'm Maggie Dawn. She's Anya Esther. Change gon' come. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know. Welcome back, Wisconsin. My name is Maggie Dawn. I'm joined today by my producer and friend, but today very special guest, Anya Esther. Today's episode is a sequel, a part two to our show from Monday, where we were observing Holocaust Remembrance Day. And today we're tackling what I think is probably one of the most complex topics of international relations and can feel so very distant, I think, for regular folks going about their day-to-day lives. And that is, what do we do? How do we understand? How do we grapple with genocide or crimes against humanity as it happens in the world? What role does each of us have? What lessons from history are there? And so we're trying to dig in. I grew up in a time in the 1990s where there were a number of genocides that were in the news on a near daily basis, and spent a good amount of my young adulthood trying to study international relations and foreign policy. I'm no expert in any of that, but I do bring, I think, my lawyer's eye and those experiences to the table and hopefully to the conversation today. And Anya brings her perspective as a convert to Judaism and as a person walking through the world today with that lived experience. So join us. If you have questions, comments, we will get to you. Please be patient. 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. And one of the takeaways from today that I hope people recall is that these are not new questions. These are questions since the birth of our nation, the Monroe Doctrine, George Washington was an isolationist. We had these debates dating back to Teddy Roosevelt's time and Woodrow Wilson before World War I. And it's also extraordinarily important to remember that in leading up to World War II, there was a very isolationist wing if not bipartisan majority opinion in the United States. 11 years passed between the beginning of the Nazi persecution of German Jews and the creation here in the United States of the War Refugee Board. It took 11 years. And if you don't remember the War Refugee Board, it was the government agency that saved tens of thousands of lives in the final 17 months of World War II. Now, obviously, much, much more could have and should have been done by the United States. And it's interesting to note that President Kennedy was deeply affected by his own father's isolationist position. He disagreed with it. He grappled with that as a young man. And so, of course, it has echoes in the Cold War, which then has the ripples in our discussion today. One of the documents I pulled to help prepare for today was the United States' response filed on September 7th of 2022 in the International Court of Justice in response to Russia's claim that it invaded Ukraine to stop alleged genocide in Ukraine. If you forgot that that was the pretext here, that was the pretext.
Forgot, or like me, didn't even hear that bit way back in the day. So very, very interested to hear that that was Putin's claim. Wow. Yeah.
Well, and that there were sort of ethnically Russian people right in Ukraine. And that so that's part of this whole, again, it's, we can't avoid the fact that all of these dominoes of history come rifling right up to our noses today. That whole propaganda machine from Putin and basically alleging this genocide is what Marjorie Taylor Greene gets on the House of the floor of, on the floor of the House of the Representatives and spouts. Ron Johnson voted against funding for Ukraine. Here we are. This is history not knocking, but basically bulldozing through the door, right? I think trying to get our arms around why Holocaust denialism is a thing is tricky. I have always been like, were you homeschooled? I mean, I don't mean to be so flip at all, but it was just always like, what are you even talking about?
Right. Right. It's the maybe most human reaction I can have to Holocaust denial. And I try to not, you know, similarly to how we spoke on Monday about films that portray the Nazi point of view, you talk about it's important that Zone of Interest shows how hard they fought to ignore the atrocities they were committing, but also in film, we don't want to humanize or over-empathize with perpetrators. You end up walking away from the film with the wrong message. In that way, I don't want to over-empathize with those who choose to, certainly anyone who chooses to spew Holocaust denial, but to throw forward some empathy for those who are tricked by it momentarily or long-term. I can certainly empathize with the fact that it is hard to believe that this happened. Because it is a horrifying, unimaginable, huge event. When I traveled to Europe and I stood in a gas chamber and I stood on lands that were concentration camps, and you look, it cannot, even in those in-person experiences, you can't go. I've put my hand to the wall of a gas chamber covered in fingernail markings, and I still can't entirely comprehend that I was in that room and what that room's history was. So to a certain small extent, I understand the response to go, that can't be. That's too big. That's too many people. That's so much. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. But to cling to that from the fear, from the inability is not appropriate or acceptable, of course, right? So in that small amount, I try to cling to this idea of, I get it. It's huge. I've tried studying it. I have to walk away from it sometimes.
Yes.
But I can't walk away from it going, well, it doesn't matter, or worse, it's not real. I walk away from it and I go, it's so real that it hurts.
I am forced, compelled to say this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that all the time about today's political environment and the choices that we face. We cannot stand in denial of what this choice means.
Right.
This November.
Yes. Yep.
It's just those that do so, I think, in large part from the safety that whiteness, that Christianity, from this perch of safety.
Yes. Yeah, I would say so. I think there's a lot of American folks who, you know, I'm a Jewish woman. I'm a woman of queer experience. I'm a woman, period.
Right.
So I, of course, am looking at America, my time here in America, and going, you know, to put it in a radio safe way, you know, what are we doing? How close are we getting? I think there's a lot of Americans who are still in the mindset of either it could never happen here or it could never happen to me. You know, it's not going to be me who gets affected. And I just like to remind people, you know, fascism is a self-necrotizing disease. It may start in the foot, seeks to destroy the foot. You may think you're okay because you're an eyebrow, you're way up here. But once it's done with the foot, it will destroy the leg. And when it's done with the leg, it will destroy the torso. Right. It will make its way up. If you're all that's left, it will take you out too. That might take a while, but I think it's important to remember that fascism and sort of the disease that Nazism put forward, the destruction of other human beings, in the end, it will come for us all. How close or how far away you see yourself from the victims that have already been taken, it will come for us all. And we have to be actively pushing against that, whether it's voting, talking about these things. That's what bearing witness is to gather the knowledge and be able to say, hey, I see that you're doing this thing. I know that the last time someone did this thing, people got hurt, people got killed, lives were lost, institutions were all these awful, awful things. That's why I'm going to say something now, because I've seen it and I don't want it to happen again. That's really at its core, on a broad sense, what people can do.
Well, and I believe, you know, in 2005, the United Nations adopted a principle called the responsibility to protect. That, I mean, deep within myself, at times I want to cry out to my fellow citizens, my fellow Wisconsinites, my friends and family, and say, do we not have a responsibility to one another? Weren't we all raised with that same idea?
Right.
That we have a responsibility to protect our democracy, to stand, to bear witness, to vote, to accept this deep civic responsibility, and to do so with some humility and reverence for other people.
Mm-hmm.
The dignity of other people. And I just, to be facing a choice where one of the primary candidates for the presidency of the United States talks about poisoning the blood of Americans, talks about human beings as animals, talks about countries as blank hole countries, talks about Nazis as being good people. I mean, that's what the man said.
Right, right. And I want to state how much of the Trump rhetoric in 2019, when I was on my fellowship trip to Germany and Poland, we stopped at the house known as the Wannsee House, where the Wannsee conference occurred. Huge mansion on the Wannsee, now turned into a museum about Nazi propaganda. And I want to be clear, I have scans of posters from the Nazi era where rhetoric surrounding comparing Jewish people to rats, comparing Polish people to vermin. The language of blood and of poison, I want to be clear, it really truly comes directly from Himmler and Goebbels's playbook.
Yes.
I don't say that to be, you know, the annoying liberal who goes, oh, Trump's a Nazi or something. I say it to go, in 2019, I visited the house that these choices occurred in and saw the exact same language in German that is being used in English today. And it's very, very scary. All you can do is sigh after.
Yes. Yeah. We've got callers. Thank you for being patient. We're going to start to go to the phones. If you want to join our discussion, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. What is our responsibility to protect one another? And how does that translate in the individual decisions that we make every day, our decisions as voters? What does your vote symbolize? What does it mean when you try to stack that up with your own moral compass? If you disavow these things, I'm no Nazi. I'm no racist. I'm no anti-Semite. Then what is your vote? On which side of history will you choose to be counted? These are the questions faced today. They aren't hypothetical. It is not rhetorical. It is not hysteria. And again, these are not new questions for the United States or for the people that live in free and open society. These have been age-old questions. My hope is that when faced with these challenges, that we don't shrink from them, we don't turn inward, that we extend a hand to one another and say, this is not acceptable. This speech is not acceptable, to shout it back down. A person may have the right to say abhorrent, terrible things, but we can then, you and me and Anya and Calvin, we get to respond and shout that back down. Please stay tuned, everybody. We're going to take a couple of quick messages. We're going to go to the phones. You want to join our conversation, like to text and participate, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Don't go anywhere. I'm Maggie Dawn. She's Anya Esther. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. And it's 4 a.m. again. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. We're having a special second episode this week. Our first was Monday. If you missed that, you can go to civicmedia.us to check it out. I pulled my friend and producer out of the booth into the interviewee guest chair to have Monday's episode, an observation of Holocaust Remembrance Day, and to have what I think is then the necessary second level of conversation, which is never again, but how? Never again, but how? Let's take some callers. If you've never called in before, please let Calvin know. He's manning the phones. You'll go to the top of the list if you've not called in before. 855-75-CIVIC. Please let Calvin know that. 855-752-4842. Calvin, let's take Carolyn from Madison. Carolyn from Madison, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show. What would you like to share this afternoon?
Hi. Since Monday's show, when Anya pointed out how the Levant and how these three religions came out of, was it the Levant? Am I right about that?
Yep, that's the right terminology. Yep.
Okay. I was thinking how there might have been at the time or through that time some fascist wannabes who wanted to control that whole area. And I mean, there's parts of the three Abrahamic religions that I really like, you know, the holidays and things that the kind of celebrations and things they celebrate and stuff like that. But I'm just wondering, they provided a convenient them for anybody who, you know, like Hitler needed a them to protect his people against, and Trump's doing the same thing these days.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. When we think about what are the predicate steps, what are the first things that happen to get to a genocide, the language we use today is otherizing, you take someone and you say, well, they're not us. That's them. They're bad. When you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and if you haven't been there, I highly recommend. They actually break down the 10 stages of genocide. And the first stage is to classify the other. You know, like migrants poisoning the blood of America, and they're not humans, they're animals. You know that. Step one, classification. Andrew from Detroit, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show. What do you have to say this afternoon?
Good afternoon, ladies. We have to remember that this has been going on in this landmass we call the United States since the beginning. When the colonists came over, the New England colonies, they wanted to impose English rule on the Native Americans. And we had the King Philip's War go on there. And then always and always with different people that were either brought onto this landmass or already lived here. What we did with the Trail of Tears with the Native Americans, what we did with importing Africans to this country, what we did with importing the Chinese to build the railroads, what we did to imprison the Japanese. It's always been, this is mine, and you're in my way. And if you've got to be here, I've got to do something about you. And it happens all over the world. Maybe it started with the Vikings going. I don't know. But I think I'm from a culture that probably has some Viking blood and probably from a culture that has some Jewish blood. But this happens all over the world when somebody goes in and I claim this in the name of. I mean, thank God there was nobody on the moon, or it would have happened to them as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew.
Yeah, nobody on the moon, or it would happen there as well. If you are going to oppress another human being, if you are going to strip away any dignity or rights, you have to do it with an excuse. You have to come up with the framework that makes that acceptable. And you do that by classifying, by then having people wear a symbol of their classification or using various symbols to represent that classification. The Star of David, a blue scarf in Cambodia, in the 90s, a white armband in Bosnia. And then you discriminate, then you change the laws to isolate the other that we now can identify because there is a symbol, and then you dehumanize repeatedly. Those are the four first steps to genocide. Does any of this ring a bell for people? I mean, what are we doing? Dave from Madison, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show.
Yeah, hi, Jason Stanley from Yale. It's a great book. I forget what it's called. It's about fascism. But, you know, you can read that, and then you can see its connection to today. And that's why I'm really glad you're doing the show. And you're drawing a connection to today. You know, it's this other, a lot of people mention other, them, that kind of thing. You know, it's like watching the run-up to World War II. It really is. These, you know, our ethnic nationalists, they take a group. And in this case, at our time, instead of the Jews, although now it includes the Jews too, but instead of the Jews largely, it's they go after immigrants. And it's a worldwide phenomenon, and that's why it's happening here with Donald Trump, who's a right-wing populist. But you know, you have the AfD in Germany polling at much higher than the Social Democratic Party, and Meloni, who just became prime minister of Italy.
We've got to Hang on there, Dave. I want you to come back after top of the hour, Dave, and make this point about the parties in Germany. So if Calvin, if we can keep Dave, we'll do that. I'm Maggie Dawn. She's Anya Esther. Part two of Holocaust Remembrance Day. How do you, an individual, help prevent and stand up to genocide? Don't go anywhere. We'll be back after news, weather, and sports. I heard you say